That isn't just the sound of the 2016 Mercedes-Benz C-Class high-strength steel and aluminum frame being formed. It's the sound of conviction. Conviction that created a lighter, quicker, and more efficient C-Class, whose beautiful form commands attention, while its more powerful, fuel-efficient engine demands to be driven. This is what conviction sounds like. Now, discover what it feels like in a 2016 Mercedes-Benz C-Class.
Blog Talk Radio.
It's not the same in other towns, along the coast, both up and down. There's nowhere else, just look around. It feels like home to me. Called Lake Worth in Florida, on any map you'll see. From John Prince Park to Ocean Shore, it feels like home to me. A sleepy town most of the time, taking a show, drink beer or wine. Cool little shops, no waiting lines. It feels like home to me. There's ocean views and fancy cars, tiki bars where you can count the stars. Be neighbors to Manuel or Lars. It feels like home to me. The parties in the plaza set, a feeling you won't soon forget. Easy, you just cast your net, and it feels like home to me. We're all can have a place in the sun, raise your kids and have some fun. With festivals for everyone, it feels like home to me.
Yes, Rachel, is that you?
Yeah, that's me. Hi, Wes.
Okay, I'm just introducing the show. Hi, you're listening to High Noon in Lake Worth. I'm your host, Wes Blackman. We bring you this show every noon on Friday to highlight issues important to Lake Worth and the South Florida area in general. And I'm an urban planner, so a lot of the discussion relates around urban planning and balancing the built environment and human needs with our sensitive ecological area and environment. And one of the things that makes Lake Worth unique is that we do have a large activist population, a large radical, if you will, population. And we're also home of the Earth's first newsletter organization. And they have chosen Lake Worth as their home. So there is a lot of curiosity about groups such as this living within our borders and what it means. And we're very pleased to have Rachel Ivey, who is not a member of that organization, but is a member of what is called the Deep Green Resistance. And thank you, Rachel, for coming on the air today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Instead of me reading about the Deep Green Resistance and what it means, why don't you give us like a 5-minute introduction about your role and the history of the organization and what its chief principles are?
Yeah, absolutely. So DGR is a young organization. It came out of a book by the same name, Deep Green Resistance, which detailed a specific strategy for resisting the current culture of exploitation and environmental destruction. So out of that book came our organization, which is a membership organization. We have chapters across the United States, also in Australia, Slovenia, the UK, Lebanon, and Canada, and some other places as well. So from our beginnings 2 years ago, we've kind of expanded. We have a volunteer staff, of which I am a part of, full-time organizers. There's 7 of us. We have an advisory board, which is composed of the authors of that original book and that original strategy. And DGR, in a lot of ways, shares goals with, the organization you mentioned and also some other environmental organizations. There are some things that, to me, make DGR unique and that drew me specifically to DGR.
Okay.
And I think, so one of those things is you mentioned the word radical and talking about environmental groups in Lake Worth and activists there. And I think that talking about the meaning of the word radical is very important. So radical means to get to the root of something. And DGR's hope is that we can get to the root of the source of not only environmental destruction, but oppression of marginalized peoples, oppressions of non-humans, and that same thought process playing out in a number of different social justice struggles. So I think the thing that makes DGR unique to me is that it connects or tries to connect these different, modes of exploitation together with a common thread.
I'd like to point out your website, which people can visit. It's deepgreenresistance1word.org, and you can find out a lot of written information there. And I find through reading your website and other material related to DGR is that you seem to think that there's a symbiotic relationship between the social oppression that we feel and the oppression of our industrial processes and our society, essentially.
Yes, I think that one way we can talk about that common thread is to talk about the idea of resource extraction and the exploitation that comes from that. So power is leveraged by classes of people over other classes of people, but not only over other classes of people. Humans as a class leverage power over non-humans. Humans as a class leverage power over the earth itself in order to gain material profit from that. So we can see that same mechanism, that same underlying justification of exploitation in all of these different fights. So, we have this ideology called economics or called manifest destiny or what you will to justify extracting resources from the earth. We have this ideology called race and white supremacy to justify extracting resources from non-white people and indigenous peoples across the world. And we have this ideology called gender and called patriarchy to facilitate and to justify the exploitation of female people across the world. The idea and the goal is the same. The venue is different, but the goal is the same.
Mm-hmm. And you're termed in the information that I read in some of the YouTube videos that your educational outreach, and I guess what we're doing today, is really part of the above ground portion of the organization. Is there what you would call an underground portion, and how would you define the two?
Yeah, that's another thing that I think makes DGR unique is that we explicitly define ourselves as an above ground organization, which means that the most illegal tactic that any of our DGR members are going to use is nonviolent direct action. But calling ourselves an above-ground movement, as you correctly surmised, implies that we don't think our strategy is going to be effective unless an underground or underground actions are taken as well, actions that act outside of that legal framework that we are given by those in power. DGR is not that organization. DGR members have no contact or knowledge of any organization that may or may not exist to fulfill that role. But we do acknowledge that this is a necessary part of our strategy as a whole, not just DGRs, but everyone concerned with ending the exploitation and destruction that defines our current dominant culture.
Now, DGR being an organization and its an affiliation, if you were, and we do live in a construct where we have nonprofit organizations, 501c3s, that kind of thing. Is that how DGR runs? And, of course, I'm sure you have bills to pay and a light bill and a website and minimal expenses at least. How do you fit in the regulatory framework as it relates to that, just your basic organization?
Yeah, we are not a 501c3, but you're right that what we do and what we hope to do in the future does require structure and organization and fundraising. So DGR chapters and the members within them participate in direct action. They participate in more mainstream protests. They participate in educational events to let people know, you know, the situation in each local area and to get people radicalized. But many more DGR members and the staff of which I am a part exist to facilitate that. So fundraising is a major thing that employs our time. We're currently engaged in one of the most like organized, concerted fundraising pushes that we've had so far, because things are really heating up in a lot of areas that we have DGR members over this summer. We have a lot of projects that are you know, taking off and that really require that attention. So, yeah, we are actively soliciting donations from supporters in order to do that. You know, we need frontline organizers. We need activists who are willing to put their bodies on the line to get these things done. But we also need material support. No movement can be effective without that. So for folks
right.
who can't be on the front lines, who can't, you know, devote all of their time and energy to this, that's a great way to, you know, a material way to show your solidarity and prove it.
Right. In our conversations leading up to our talk today on air, I found out that you are in South Florida, and I guess you're doing an educational thing, but what are some of the issues here that you find that need to be exposed and the root cause exposed so that we can deal with the symptoms? And just coincidentally, on a completely different level, we have a city manager in Lake Worth City Hall that says, you know, he's tired of dealing with the symptoms. We have to get to the cause so that we eliminate the symptoms in the future. And I think it's kind of barking up the same tree, but in a completely different area. Or, you know, he's completely talking about municipal services and that kind of thing, but you're talking about the environment. So can you talk about that relationship a little bit?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you mentioned municipal services and the environment. I think those are intimately connected. And you're right, I'm really happy to be back in Florida. It is my home state. I grew up in St. Pete. I've been gone for a bit, but now I'm back, and this is the place that's really, you know, close to my heart. And when I think of fighting environmental destruction, when I think of taking a stand on these issues, I think of Florida, and I think of the Gulf, and this is the specific place that I am fighting for with all the work that I'm trying to do. So I think of specifically, I'm going to Miami tomorrow to meet with some folks on these issues, and I know that they are dealing with, you know, a nuclear plant, which is something that is common, increasingly so. But like you mentioned, we don't want to just deal with the symptoms. You know, a nuclear plant is a pretty dire symptom, and I don't mean to trivialize it by calling it a symptom. But another thing that I think makes DGR unique is that we don't want to just address those symptoms of environmental destruction. We want to get to the root of those. And to us, the root is the system called civilization. Civilization, for a lot of people, means human society. It means the same thing as human society. But human societies have not always been civilized. Civilized cultures rely on resource extraction and domination in order to maintain themselves. So when we talk about ending the symptoms, we need to look at that root cause. What kind of culture requires resource extraction, especially such a dangerous type of resource extraction that the folks in South Florida are dealing with, in order to just maintain its basic functions. So we need to not only look at those symptoms and stopping those, but also what kind of culture requires this and how can we create something new.
Now, how does population fit into the whole equation? Because we live in a metropolitan area that is South Florida of about 5 million people, and it essentially was created or allowed to be created by the extension of the railway, which is an industrial process, the extension of roadways, which are part of the industrial process, and the domination of the automobile. And being an urban planner, I deal with that all the time. And now we're in a situation where we have a built environment that is made to support this population, imported population of 5 million people, essentially over the past 100 years, that this particular land was not ever meant to support, basically, and that's why we're running up against the edge of some of these things. So if you take the ultimate expression of your organization's desires, saying that civilization is the problem in and of itself, how would South Florida be different were your organization to achieve its goals?
So the difference between civilized societies and cultures that use a different non-exploitative structure is that human societies that are not engaged in civilized practices are able to live within the means of the land that they exist on. So every land has a carrying capacity, not only for humans, but for every type of creature fits into a place, into this pattern of how life functions and reproduces itself in each place. What largely oil culture, but also machine culture in general has done is allow our cultures to artificially inflate their populations. We're living on borrowed resources, because when you put too many people on one small piece of land, they have to get those resources from somewhere else in order to sustain themselves. So sometimes that means committing genocide of indigenous peoples and stealing their land. Sometimes it means drilling in the Gulf in order to perform our agriculture and our automobile culture. And sometimes it means exploiting female humans in order to make sure that human reproduction occurs under control. And I think that's something that often gets left out when we talk about population. Globally, 3 out of 5 births are unintended, which means that they were either the product of lack of access to reproductive control, lack of access to control over women's own bodies with regard to rape and the culture that they live in. And it disturbs me that I don't hear that mentioned very often in discussions of population is, this culture needs to extract resources in order to survive. And female people under this culture are considered that resource. We are both the extraction site and the resource itself. And that does not get talked about anywhere near enough.
And I understand what you're saying there, but in terms of answering the question, the existing situation is that we have 5 million souls, if you will, living in this fragile environment that keeps it going through the input of the industrial civilization of oppressive technologies and some would say an oppressive justice system. So what if your organization were to achieve its goal and have a better balance between the built environment, the human population, and the ecosystem or the ecology of the land, how different would our place where we live now be in South Florida? And you could extend that around the earth, too.
Well, yeah, it would have to be very different. And I think that it's common and really understandable that when we speak on this topic, The question is, well, what now? We can talk about what's wrong with this. We can talk about the problems. But in a practical sense, what can we actually do?
Right.
And I think the first thing to mention is that I think it's very important to have this conversation, but I also think it's important to emphasize that this choice is also out of our hands to a certain degree. In terms of population, if a current ecosystem can only support a certain number of individuals, then at a certain point, no matter what we want to happen, it is not going to support us any longer. So in terms of averting the most disastrous consequences of that, you know, we need to think about how are we, you know, take an example of food production. So without the resources that have allowed us to artificially inflate that, how can we live in harmony with this? And, you know, I can't answer that for every place that everyone lives. I don't even think I can answer it right now satisfactorily for the place that I live. But I think that it's one of the most important questions that as a community, you know, as small municipalities, as, you know, humans looking to survive the next century, then, you know, I think that's the most pressing question that we can begin to plan for and to strategize around.
Okay. Well, a good local issue and a good example of a global crisis, if you will, is regardless of the cause, and the scientific evidence is pretty convincing that the global warming is happening, the climate is changing with unknown ramifications. But we're actually seeing the result now, and it's hard to argue with that in the sea level rise. So that would have perhaps an immediate or more immediate implication to the South Florida area. And I'm wondering, with the and that's just one of the issues. So how does an organization such as yours address multiple hot-button issues that all are very important? I mean, how do you prioritize them?
Well, I think, you know, my answer as a staff member, I think I'm in a facilitator role a lot of the time in terms of our chapters and what our members need. And I think that, not even just talking about DGR, but as activists in general, what we can do is empower people in each local area to figure these things out. Like I said, I'm not going to, you know, I've never lived in Lake Worth. I'm not going to know specifically what the best thing is to do there. But I do have faith that people in each local area have the power to figure these things out. So I think that as activists, what we can be doing is empowering local communities to, you know, take action on these things in the best way that they know how and trust them to know what is best for their communities and their areas and give them the resources to act on that.
Okay. What are the reasons that you've popped up or DGR popped up on the radar screen here locally is that there seems to have been some sort of feud between the Earth First people and DGR as it relates to the definition of gender and the oppressiveness of the male role and that kind of thing. And why don't you address your organization's view of the patriarchy that we exist under as a society and the traditional preference given to males and that kind of thing, and just the role of gender as it relates to some of the symptoms that we're experiencing here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, over email, my first impulse and that I mentioned to you when you brought this up was to reframe the question, because I don't see this as being about DGR or about Earth First. You know, I think there are political similarities and political differences there. There are people in DGR that consider themselves part of Earth First. But honestly, I think we do a disservice to this conversation if we limit it to just talking about our groups and how we're you know, responding to this. So
okay, no, I agree.
So DGR stance and my stance, this is the thing that I was a feminist activist before I was an environmental activist, and DGR's feminist stance is what drew me to it originally. So as I mentioned, I think it's very important that we connect all oppressions under a common framework of how they work and the root of their effect in our lives. So when we talk about gender is a system by which female people upon birth are socialized into a submissive role. So if you think about the most superficial aspects of femininity, like dress and mannerism, if you actually look at those things, every feminine mannerism is a way of ritualistically showing submission. That doesn't mean that's what it means for every individual. That doesn't mean that we necessarily have control over the way that we are raised or the way that we act. But we do need to look at the root, the cultural root of where those practices come from. We look at feminine beauty practices. They're usually, well, not usually, always based on the degradation of the female body, the control of it by this culture. On the converse side, we look at masculinity, and this is a, this is an ideology and a system of behavior based on domination. So the way one becomes socialized to being a real man is to break boundaries and to, you know, exemplify aggression and to degrade females. So we do not see this system of behavior and this ideology as natural. Gender is imposed upon humans for the purpose of facilitating female submission. So when we talk about resource extraction, you know, I think it's very fitting. I'm very glad that we're having this conversation on the fourth anniversary of the murder of Dr. George Tiller in Kansas. Dr. Tiller was a doctor who performed abortions, and specifically late-term abortions, and he was murdered in his church on May 31st of 2009. So when we talk about gender and we talk about whether it's natural or voluntary and we talk about where it comes from and, you know, whether we should be fighting it, we're not talking about the real issue, which is that gender exists to justify resource extraction being performed on female bodies, whether it's the extraction of human reproduction, of male sexual gratification or cheap labor, doesn't matter, because what matters is the definition of patriarchy and the function of patriarchy is to control that that allowance of resource extraction. And gender is just the veneer. Gender is just the ideology that makes us feel like we can't fight that. And that's why DGR advocates for gender's abolition.
So it's essentially a false distinction. But and from my point of view, I see sexuality as a continuum, and we are in a frame and a structure that is built a certain way, and that's kind of the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that right now it's the way it is, but I think that if we accept that that's the way it always has to be, then we are dooming half the population to being considered inferior under the law, under their culture, under the ideologies that drive this society forward. And DGR stance is that we refuse to capitulate to that and to see it as inevitable. We choose to fight it.
Okay, so I'm a man. You're talking to a man here. And if I were to appear in your organization or want to be a part of your organization, any man knocking on the door, is there a presupposition that that person in that male body or appearing as a man is going to act in a certain way? Is there a certain stereotyping going on? Or are you willing to accept the individual for who they are based upon their behavior?
So DGR is inclusive of everyone. And what we ask is that people that have that socialization and recognize that they are benefiting as a class from the exploitation of females. We, you know, when we talk about gender, the superficial aspects of it and the enactment of it in our own lives is something that affects everyone. And, you know, no one, even when you understand these things, can just jettison all that right away. But what we ask of male DGR members is to recognize that they are benefiting from the exploitation of females as a class, and we ask them to counteract that in every way that they know how. So we are very intentional about promoting female leadership. We are very intentional about creating female-only space for activists to organize within. It's challenging as a female person to organize with male people because of those impulses and those, cultural entitlements that affect all of us. So it's very important to us that we create a space where female activists don't have to grapple with that. And what we ask of male activists is to respect that and to counteract their own, power and privilege in this culture in any way they know how.
Okay. And would you say that DGR is a hierarchical organization, or do you try and be horizontal, or how are meetings led? You know, if you have a completely horizontal organization, I think that might lead to chaos and the distortion, or at least increasing difficulty in achieving your goals, just from looking from the outside in.
Right. Well, every DGR chapter chooses their own structure for their local organization. So we don't have, any guidelines for that. But what we do have for the larger organization is, I mentioned the staff and the advisory board. So the way I usually explain this is that it's a delegation of power. So administrative and, you know, those facilitation roles are often what staff folks fall into, and the advisory board is there for assistance with difficult or permanent or, emergency situations that the staff and, you know, chapters need guidance on. So I think that structure is not necessarily hierarchical, and I think that's something that has kind of, you know, poisoned our movement in a lot of ways, is this idea that any structure, any organization of any type is necessarily going to be abused and is necessarily for the purpose of, destructive control. And I think that our responsibility as an organization is to use that structure and to form that organization in a way that counteracts that and that empowers chapters and members to work within that structure, instead of viewing it as a negative or something that is inherently destructive.
Okay. We're about a half hour into the show. I'd like to do a station ID. You're listening to High Noon in Lake Worth. I'm your host, Wes Blackman. Today we have the pleasure of having Rachel Ivey. She is with the Deep Green Resistance organization. She's a volunteer staff of a number of full-time organizers. DGR is a social and environmental justice organization. I'm reading from your email from yesterday. That began less than 2 years ago. Since then, they now have members across the U.S. as well as Canada, the U.K., Slovenia, Lebanon, Australia, as well as non-member supporters across the world. And DGR activists engage in community organizing, education, solidarity work, and direct action. Your organization is known for its founder, Derek Jensen, and I think he authored a book called Deep Green Resistance. Is he one of the forefathers, for lack of a better word, of this organization?
Yeah, he and Leah Keith both contributed to that book, and they are both on our advisory board.
Okay. And Leah, I know I've seen a YouTube video, and she is famous, I guess, for being a vegan for 20 years, and that almost ended up killing her because she developed some health problems and now is going out and educating people in terms of nutrition. But that's another way to think of our whole industrial agricultural process that supports our life and exactly what we are putting into our bodies and what that's doing to us as a nation health-wise and obesity-wise and that kind of thing. Is there anything that you can tell us about that aspect of your organization, or is that part of your organization's focus?
Well, yes and no. Nutritionally, I mean, DGR isn't, you know, issuing dictums about what people should or can eat, obviously. But, in terms of the political instead of the personal implications of agriculture are very, imminent to DGR strategy. So a lot of folks correctly identify the factory farming system and the way that we extract resources from non-humans for food as a problem. It's exploitative. It's, wrong in every way. But that also extends to plant agriculture, the way that it is performed, but also its basic function is to degrade the soil. The moment you till soil, the moment you disturb it and expose it to the sun, you are degrading it. So our current food system, based on monocrop agriculture, is quickly destroying thousands, millions of years of fossil soil that is a finite resource. And this, again, falls under our same analysis of the ways that our dominant culture extracts resources and dominates not only humans and non-humans, but the earth itself and all life.
Hmm. And again, the practical realization of a goal or changing that system, how would that manifest?
So cultivation does not necessarily mean agriculture. There are ways of cultivating food that do not involve monocrop agriculture. An alternative is permaculture, where food is acquired through an interactive system of plants and animals in a way that mimics a natural ecosystem. And you know, even broader than that, plenty of human cultures that are fast being eradicated from the earth by the dominant culture acquire their food in a way that doesn't require manipulating the environment around them at all. And you know, either of these are much preferable alternatives to the huge agribusiness model that we currently have and that we currently rely on. You know, a limited number of corporations control the entirety of the food supply that most people have access to. And yeah, that definitely plays into the model of economic and environmental exploitation that guides every part of this culture, including our food acquisition.
Right. And of course, the big headline issue right now is the genetically modified produce. And the Monsanto patented seed that really is being purveyed in our grocery stores. And we're seem to be one of the few countries that is not considering labeling. We might be considering it, but we're having a hard time labeling those GMO products. And that goes to animals, too, I guess.
Yeah, so this culture's model for profit acquisition is necessarily based on control. And I think one of the most insidious forms of control when we talk about agriculture is controlling and modifying the very DNA of organisms in order to make them the most profitable and easily manipulated, supposedly, in order to generate profit for these companies. So, you know, again, that's a very dire symptom of a larger truth about what this culture does and what it needs to survive. So we can address these symptoms, and we have to be addressing these symptoms, but we need to do it with a long view of the larger forces at work and with an eye to how our strategy can address those systems as a whole as well as addressing the symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you would your organization ever get into perhaps a local political race, whether it be a city the size of, say, Miami or Fort Lauderdale, or a smaller community such as Lake Worth for, you know, relatively minor issues in terms of a global scale as it related to building height, for example, or other kinds of development matters?
That's not something that's happened with DGR members as of yet, but it has been talked about. I know that in Lake Worth, there have been efforts similar to that. And I think that, you know, we talk about acting outside of the legal and judicial systems, acting outside the normal channels of power, but we have to be strategic in all of these actions. So, you know, dogmatically avoiding you know, local politics or, you know, engagement with more mainstream channels of power within our communities is not going to help anyone. We need to have an eye to what are our goals and how can we accomplish them. So I think that, you know, if DGR members ever are in a position to leverage power in that way, I think they will have the organization's support. And that's something that I think is happening on a, not local government, but in terms of getting involved in community organizations, you know, community empowerment in terms of local democracy and, you know, food systems. That's something that DGR members are participating in, and I think it's something that we're very excited to see continue.
How do you handle, then, conflict between people who might share similar goals but might have obstacles in terms of getting there and just, you know, kind of bumping into each other over what might seem smaller issues in the bigger picture of things? Because you are talking about the ultimate bigger picture here, which is the entire planet.
Yeah, so I think, you know, this also goes back to to strategy, and it goes back to how we handle political disagreements and practical disagreements within our organizations. I've been rather alarmed lately dealing with this issue around political attitudes and actions around gender and around sex oppression, that I really haven't seen very much thoughtful, substantive debate about this. When we talk about allying with other organizations, the stakes are high. People that get into radical politics have strong feelings about what's going on and about their opinions. And we are going to disagree. It's going to be painful and it's going to be difficult, but it's going to happen. And, my experience as an activist and as a feminist has been that for every thoughtful question or, someone willing to agree to disagree, I've gotten three threats of violence and, attempts to blacklist me from speaking somewhere. And, it's upsetting in a personal sense, of course, but in a larger sense, it makes me worried for how, we call ourselves a movement, but a movement can cooperate and can ally past political disagreements in order to accomplish goals that we do share in common. And that's, frankly, not something that I see happen enough, especially recently. So I think that go on.
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say that, in terms of not just UGR and not just any other organization, but our movements for social justice as a whole, I think we need to be more strategic than dogmatic, and dogmatism is what I feel like we've been experiencing more of lately. I would like to see that change.
Now, we are working in the framework here in the United States of America where we have the First Amendment and freedom of speech and freedom of opinion, freedom of association. And I would think to some degree that your organization and other organizations similar to yours or my chair members with would adhere to the principles of the importance of freedom of expression, freedom of speech, freedom of opinion. And I appreciate your mention of dogma here. I would think that your community would be a hotbed of democracy and want to encourage discussion and different opinions.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are great examples of this. I think that in terms of just within DGR is where I have the most experience. Plenty of DGR chapters are able to ally with groups that are more liberal and mainstream, that they may not share the same opinion on civilization's inherent insustainability, but they do share, the goal of ending fracking or of, ending resource extraction in that specific area. Mm-hmm. So, we are going to disagree. The First Amendment is selectively enforced in terms of the law, but I think within our own movements, we can do better than that. We can be discerning about which narratives are being privileged here and which are being subjugated, which are being silenced, because there's a political motive behind all of those, and we enact them without thinking a lot of the time. So when we talk about freedom of speech and freedom of expression, we need to think about the fact that even within our movements, especially when they, as you said, are horizontal in that way and leadership is not explicit, we enact the political and social forces that we have been raised up within. And I think being aware of that and being conscious of that is necessary to make sure that we can counteract it within our movements.
Okay. We have about 15 minutes left. I'll do another station ID here. You are listening to High Noon in Lake Worth. This is a program that comes to you every Friday noon and talks about issues related to Lake Worth, the South Florida region, and today we're talking about our Earth, our planet Earth, our spaceship that we're on here. And we have a guest with us, Rachel Ivey, who is with the Deep Green Resistance Movement. She's a full-time volunteer, and want to touch on the notion of that full-time volunteer. Is there a way that you are able to function in our material society, and we're dealing with currency and the rent is due at the beginning of the month and that kind of thing? Can you be a full-time volunteer and live in our society?
It's a challenge. You're definitely right about that. Our staff members and our members more generally, I think a lot of sacrifices have to be made to do the type of as you said, volunteer and, you know, unremunerated work that needs to be done. So, yeah, some of our activists have, you know, full-time jobs and they, you know, are able to participate less. Some of us are able to maybe with part-time jobs. Plenty of people end up, you know, unemployed or living in more unstable ways in order to sustain this work. So, yeah, it's definitely challenging. You're right about that.
Okay. One of the videos I saw discussed the distinction between what a liberal is and what a radical is. And there's some sense on my part that I got from watching that your organization would like to make a clear distinction about the difference of being progressive or liberal and the difference of being a radical. Do you want to touch on those distinctions?
Yeah, I think that's very important because we often hear the word radical sort of thrown around. A lot of people will use it to describe, you know, something they agree with or something that they like best. But when we use that word so carelessly, we lose sight of its actual meaning. Radical and liberal are specific approaches to activism and to social change that have effects in terms of how they play out in the real world. So just to give you a short summary of that, so for instance, radical political ideology is collectivist. We think that power is leveraged by groups of people over other groups of people. It's class-based. So when we talked about patriarchy, males as a class are leveraging power over females as a class in order to extract reproductive resources, for instance. And this is not an individual phenomenon. So if I, as a female, say, well, I don't want to identify with this, I don't want to have any part of this, I can do my best to remove myself from that system, but because that's not how power works, it's still going to affect me, and it's still going to go on without me, even if I manage to escape. So liberal ideology, on the other hand, is individualist. It sees power as being under individual control, but this does not pan out in the way that power is actually leveraged, and we can see that in the results of activism based on individualism, such as buying green consumer choices or, you know, personally trying to reduce your carbon footprint. It's not that these things aren't maybe, you know, helpful in a minuscule, you know, personal sort of way, but in terms of leveraging power in a larger strategy, this is not a plan with a future.
Okay.
So that's one aspect of several that distinguishes liberal from radical ideology.
Okay. One thing that's going on in the background here in terms of the built environment is that we're embarking as a region on a transportation alternative, and that would be a rail link between municipalities along the coast. We have one right now called Tri-Rail, which is right next to I-95, which was built as a temporary solution but has become more permanent and is carrying more people. And there's a push to do that in funding, and the program is underway, and probably within 3 to 5 years we'll have a train running through the eastern municipalities here. And the emphasis of doing that is that we have a situation where population keeps moving to South Florida. People need to go somewhere, and instead of putting them in more environmentally sensitive areas further west above the Everglades and other sensitive areas and watersheds and Lake Okeechobee, to direct them in areas that are urban that have already been environmentally disturbed. How would your organization take a view of that in terms of directing what growth there might be just through the course of human activity to a certain area and direct that to areas that have already been ecologically and environmentally disturbed over others, or over the choice of just telling people that they can't come here?
Well, I think for any strategy, it's important to have short and long-term goals. So, you know, you mentioned redirecting folks away from the Everglades, you know, towards the west, towards places that are already disturbed. I think in terms of short-term protection of those ecosystems and their inhabitants, I think that's very valuable. I think that's something that needs to be talked about. But I think that we also can't stop there, not just with regard to this example, but with regard to the ecological destruction caused by human activity in general. As I mentioned before, we have to think about what kind of culture, what kind of society needs to destroy its home in order to survive in the short term, and what is that going to mean for our long-term survival. So I think in terms of strategy, it's important to look at those short-term things, but we also need to think about a long-term solution with regard to population, as we talked about, with regard to the structure of our living situation on the planet, and think about how can we alter that fundamental structure so that these things are not necessary. But in the short term, mm-hmm. I would definitely agree with you that that's very important.
Okay. What about the sense of feeling of the individual that, geez, you know, I'm only one person and I can only do so much. I can only recycle so much. I can only ride my bike so much, because that person in the SUV still is going to do their 40-minute commute to work and back while I'm riding my bike. And we have a situation now where we have almost 2 billion people in China that are using dirty energy. They're using a lot of coal. They're destroying their own environment, which is having its own local implications, but I'm sure it has global implications. How do you get over the individual malaise that the problems just are too gigantic that any one person really can't affect change?
I think that's a great way to demonstrate the way that liberal ideology ultimately serves the preservation of power and the status quo, because that focus on individualism, as you mentioned, it not only is ineffective in terms of our actions, but if you believe that the only way that anyone can have an effect is as an atomized individual, you know, and just what they can accomplish on their own, I don't know how anyone could avoid becoming burned out and, you know, just feeling utter despair and hopelessness at that mm-hmm. notion. And I think what the ameliorating factor with that is that, you know, we are not actually individuals. I mean, we are, obviously, but we don't have to accept that that's the only way to enact change. You know, within our groups, within our movements, you know, within the alliances we can build and the cooperation that we can demonstrate, that's where our power lies. So for anyone mm-hmm. feeling that way, that they, you know, can't have an effect on their own, I would encourage them to follow that logic to its end. If we can't have an effect on our own, then what are we going to do? And I think the answer yeah. should be that we need to organize.
Okay. And then what do you do in the example of China, who might be shielding its sovereignty through the UN and other means? And what do we in the United States have that we can do to alter the way China behaves, because they're the elephant in the living room?
Well, the first thing that popped into my head as you were talking about that is the phrase, think globally, act locally. So I think that people in the U.S. don't have control and don't have the, you know, the necessary knowledge of the situation on the other side of the planet to affect change there. I think that in terms of solidarity and in terms of trying to empower folks that are marginalized, that aren't in our areas, that's definitely something that we can do through, you know, funding and through public support. But in terms of strategy and knowing what actions are best to take, as I said, I wouldn't feel comfortable making recommendations for Lake Worth necessarily, because I've never lived there. I've never been a part of that community. And I think the same goes for China. There are ways that we can help, but I don't think that we can direct or make coherent recommendations necessarily for people in those areas. I think that local resistance and cooperation is the way that the social change is going to be leveraged. And I think that empowering folks to do that in their local areas is what we should be focusing on.
Okay. We have about 5 minutes left. I'd like to do one more station ID here. You're listening to High Noon in Lake Worth. My name is Wes Blackman. I'm your host. And we do this show every Friday at noon to keep you informed about topics that are important to Lake Worth, South Florida, Florida, the nation, and the world. And today is a good example. We're talking with the volunteer staff organizer of DGR, which is short for Deep Green Resistance. We have a large number of activists and anarchists and people concerned about the environment living in Lake Worth, and I thought it would be good to have an understanding from one of the organizations similar to those people who are living here, and educate people who may not be associated or wonder about what it means to be a radical and that kind of thing. So I really do appreciate your time, Rachel, today giving us. In the time that we have, do you want to kind of sum up and maybe direct people to where they could get more information on your organization, or if you're going to be at a public event in the near future, maybe direct them there, or if there's a way to contribute to your organization, that's something your organization is looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is deepgreenresistance.org. We also have a Facebook page named Deep Green Resistance. There are a lot of things that are being worked on this summer. Activists in the Great Plains are doing indigenous solidarity work on the Pine Ridge Reservation, fighting the exploitative liquor industry. You know, we have folks fighting the Utah tar sands coming up in July. We have educational events going on in the Northeast, and a variety of other projects that are coming up really soon. So for folks that want to contribute and support that, I would definitely look up and see if there are DGR activists in your area that you could get in touch with. We have a list of the chapters on our website. And you can also donate to us through that website. Your money goes directly to funding gas and food and, you know, travel and logistics for activists trying to get to actions and trying to support themselves while they do it. Thank you so much for having me on, Wes.
Well, I want to thank you, Rachel, and it's nice to have a conversation with someone who is involved in this movement. And, you know, we didn't raise our voices or anything like that. I think we explored some interesting topics. So I hope it was interesting to our listenership. And best of luck with your time here in South Florida. And I'm going to turn on Mel and Vinny, who are part-time Lake Worth residents here. And they're going to sing Feels Like Home to Me as we finish out the hour. So, again, listeners, I'd like you to thank you for tuning in. And again, this is available as an archived edition. And thank you again, Rachel.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Home to me, a sleepy town most of the time. Take in a show, drink beer or wine. Cool little shop, no waiting lines. It feels like home to me. There's ocean views and fancy cars, tiki bars where you can count the stars. Be neighbors to Manuel or Lars, it feels like home to me. The party's in the plaza set, a feeling you won't soon forget. It's easy, you just cast your net, and it feels like home to me. We're all can have a place in the sun. Raise your kids and have some fun with festivals for everyone. It feels like home to me. It feels like home to me. the towns along the coast, both up and down. There's nowhere else, just look around. It feels like home to me. It's called Lake Worth in Florida. On any map you'll see, from John.
Hey, it's Flo, and this is my impression of a beat poet. Name. Name your. Name your price. A tool, an idea, an inspiration. To do more than just say what you want to pay. Oh, no. But to see the options that could fit your budget. Steve. Steve, enough bongos.
Find car insurance that fits your budget at progressive.com.
Makes me want to dance. Steve!
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company. Price and coverage match limited by state law.